Carol. Welcome to E Pluribus Unum, the podcast where we dive deeper into the hive mind. I'm Josh.
And I'm Eric.
And today we're talking about episode 6 entitled HDP. Before we jump into the episode, though, a couple things of housekeeping to knock off our list real quick.
Absolutely. I cannot thank you all enough for getting us to 800 listeners in less than 3 weeks. It's just phenomenal. And we just want to thank everybody for taking the time to listen to our little podcast here.
Thanks so much for joining our little hive mind that we've made with E Pluribus Unum. It means a lot to us. If you like what we're doing here on E Pluribus Unum, please feel free to join us over on our other podcast entitled Dad, You're Wrong, where a Gen X dad and a millennial son talk about horror, sci-fi, and fantasy and everything in between.
And apparently I'm wrong. So there's that.
He is quite wrong, and we'll see this in this episode again. No, I'm kidding. Another fun little announcement around that, though, next week on both E Pluribus Unum and the Dad You're Wrong podcast, we will be recording for the first time ever live and in person. So that's going to be a ton of fun. Never done that before, and we may even have a special guest or two add in their own theories and opinions on Pluribus. So that'll be a great time.
Interesting stuff. I like it.
And be sure to stick around with us at the end of this episode. We're going to be supplying a couple of our extra theories. Definitely worth sticking around and hearing a couple things that we've been talking about throughout the first 5 episodes of E Pluribus Unum. This will be a bit of an extra long episode, but I think now is a perfect time to go ahead and jump into episode 6 of Pluribus entitled HDP. So what were your initial overall thoughts on this episode?
Man, Soylent Green. Those are my 2 words or my overall thoughts. For anybody that listened to the last episode, I said, if this becomes a Soylent Green situation, then I'm out. It hurt my heart to open up this episode to the Soylent Green theory, but it made me think harder about the episode as well. I'm just going to answer that question with Soylent Green. And I'm going to give you a Carol scoff.
Well, I got to say, you know, being the one that was proven right after my theory last episode, I enjoyed this one quite a bit. But I did like this episode overall. It hit a lot of things I really wanted to see and added a few more questions and a few more mysteries that I'm really excited to ponder on over the next week. So, yeah, let's go ahead and jump into this first scene here where we catch up with Carol as she exits Agrajet.
Yeah, I thought the opening scene where we see the outside of the building and you have the reverse audio as she makes her way to the door and you see the flashlight, you know, bouncing around beyond the door and she pops out real quick. I thought that was very cool. I thought it was also very alien, the way they made it look and feel, almost purposely. But she comes careening down the stairs and drops her flashlight and is obviously dismayed at what she had just seen, and everyone had theories about what this could be or should be. And I think I'm going to still fight a little bit of this, but she grabs her camera and decides to run in, and we get a sequence here where I'm sure you're probably pretty appreciative of it. We bounce back into a handheld camera situation, but rather than chasing Carol out the door, we are in Carol's hands, and she's walking us through, and she's very adamant about what she has to show us and how she breaks it down for us.
I do love a good found footage movie, so that's always great to see. And of course, we see Carol as she makes her next video throughout the Agrajet facility, and she's opening these plastic tarps and pulling out what we've come to find out are human body parts. The first one being pretty horrifyingly a severed head. I thought it was interesting that we're seeing sort of their food production, but they've also decided to leave all of this food in Albuquerque, even though it is in a frozen state. We know that the hive mind has left Albuquerque, but they didn't take what seemingly, and later on in the episode, is highlighted as something that's very important. They seemingly have left all this food there. So I assume that they're going to come back for it, or maybe the hive mind is still hiding away in Albuquerque in some way. And maybe that's a clue that they're still present in Albuquerque and it's not as empty as we have been led to believe.
Yeah, it was really aggravating. Well, look, here's my deal with the whole Soylent Green thing. The human body doesn't provide great sustenance. And this has been scientifically proven. And both the Joined, having scientists and doctors and so forth in them, as well as Vince Gilligan, would know that eating human body parts is not healthy for you. And there are some body parts that can actually kill you. You get really horrible diseases from them. The caloric intake you get from a human being is not even a third of what you would get from a horse, let's say, okay? So let's just make the assumption here that being a cannibal is wholly unhealthy for the human body, right? But there are calories there to be had in desperate situations, as we've learned. That being said, isn't the human body also, in this instance, the most processed food you could possibly ever have? We already all eat garbage, and then you're going to process that creature into some sort of caloric intake? It's absurd on its face. Now, that's the part that I don't like about the whole Soylent Green thing, or it's a cookbook Twilight Zone episode thing, is on its face, that's what this looks like. Let's look at what she showed us in the scene. She grabs a human head wrapped in saran wrap. What is the nutritional value of the human head and all the time it takes to cut these bodies up and then process them as food? It seems utterly pointless. Number one, you're not going to process a human head for food. Number two, even if you did, the human brain, by the way, is the thing that it can give you a disease that'll kill you. Number three, there's got to be a better way. And I think I found a way to answer it later, which is why I'm still here and I haven't left.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think some of that, at the very least, is marginally answered later on in this episode. But even for me, who subscribes to that theory, there are some still unanswered questions that I'm curious about.
For sure. Well, and from here, we essentially get her shot video. She gets very aggravated and she goes, what's this door and what's beyond this door? And we find out it's another, you know, further processing of human corpses. And then we get a snapshot into Carol's home and what I would call the Vegas decision.
Yeah. So at this point, Carol has her next video that she wants to send out to the survivors. And you can see, again, Ray's great performance. She doesn't have to say a word. You can see that she's processing. She doesn't want to trust the hive mind with this particular video. And of course, the closest survivor to Carol at this point is Kumba, who I mentioned he was going to be in Vegas at our particular hotel. So she decides to pack up her things and drive from Albuquerque to Vegas. But as she leaves, she instantly comes back in and vacuums up her carpet, which has the remains of the white substance, or what we find out to be HDP. And she's vacuuming that up with a mask on her face.
Well, it's the shot, right? You see her exit the door closes. And then we just see a shot of the door for almost 30 seconds. And then you see her pop back in to do this. Another great way for them to inject some humor in there. But now she jumps into her favorite car, which is the state police car. And she starts to drive off to Vegas. And when she arrives, everything is so quiet. The only thing you hear is the buzz of the lights.
Mm.
And you get this really great 28 days later scenario where there's no one in the street, there's no cars, there's no animals, there's nothing. It's just the city and it's on.
And not only the clicking on and off of lights, but that distinct sound of neon lights. The sound design on top of the visual language is what really sets the show apart.
Yeah, you know, when we get to Vegas, it's a typical Vegas sort of scenario where you have people in fancy dress and drinks and all these lovely things. They actually open the scene here with a Sammy Davis Jr. song, and then they sort of back away from a picture of Elvis Presley, another classic Vegas character, and it is a full-on Vegas party as you would ever imagine in any film. And of course, as we dig deeper into this scene, we find out it is actually influenced by a film.
Indeed, it is. Yeah, I even have it in my notes as Kumba's Casino Royale. At least I hope that's the film that you were you are referencing there.
It's definitely a James Bond film.
And I know upon Kumba's introduction, you were not the biggest Kumba fan. I didn't mind him so much in those first couple early episodes that he was in. It was with this scene that my dislike of Kumba finally came out. There are a couple things I do want to point out in this scene, though, that I did think were interesting.
All right.
In particular, it's Kumba's conversation, and the villain says, "Your luck is about to run out." And Kumba responds, "Maybe someday, but not today." And I thought that might be a little bit telling about Kumba's journey. I don't think that Kumba's going to have as happy an ending as he truly believes. I think that there may be some more repercussions for some of his actions than he realizes. He does have a distinct lack of fear, unlike the other two sort of main characters in this episode. He has sort of a king-like behavior, and he really is, most importantly, taking advantage of the hive mind and their generosity. So I do feel that that line has some pertinence and that Kumba's luck is going to run out, and it's going to run out, honestly, sooner than later. Another cool thing I want to point out in this particular scene, the chips on the table that they're betting with are a distinct color of yellow and a distinct color of blue and purple that we see quite a bit associated with the hive mind. And if you notice in particular, the villain has both yellow chips as well as blue chips, whereas Kumba is betting exclusively with the yellow chips. But I want to hear your thoughts on this Kumba scene, since Kumba is your favorite character of this entire show.
But all this episode did for his character, it colors him in a worse light. But there's a reason for it, and I'd like to flesh it out a little bit. There's sort of a back and forth between Kumba and the dealer that's cheeky. And it's cheeky in a way of, are they playing together in order for him to win? And then, you know, it plays out in the same way that anyone would expect. He wins not just with a flush. It's got to be a royal flush, right? And that's what makes everything so audacious. But also think about him and the types of fantasies he has. He has fantasies about beautiful women, several beautiful women, having a harem of women. He fantasizes of having his own suite in Vegas and everyone adoring him and laughing at all his jokes, even though they're all rote, pretending, right? But it's almost like a child. It's a kid who never had anything, now has everything. And we know so little about him that my first thought of him was he comes off as this sort of aristocrat, but it's so fake that I'm like, you know what? He was probably a dishwasher at a restaurant or something. And now he has everything. And so he doesn't want to let go of any of that stuff because of the nature of his life. And when you do a little bit of research, Kumba means that you were born from the death of your mother. Your mother died in childbirth, and so we're going to name you this. I think that tells a lot about this particular character and why he might be the way that he is. Now, again, we don't like him for his misogyny and his fantastical nature, but when you see it as a child who had nothing, now has everything, and I'm going to do everything I can to hold on to this, they're Lakshmi in another way, and they don't want the significant change, even though it's staring them bloody well in the face. And I honestly think that's why they don't like having Carol around, is because she's a reminder that this isn't right. She's a reminder that this may seem okay, and we may be willing to make compromises in their decisions in order to make it okay. They're deluded again. So he's another deluded character, and Carol is the reminder that, no, this isn't okay. But think about this. He wins. He walks away with the pithy comment. The women embrace him. He goes, anyone else like to come along? And the dealer is like, I would. And she goes off with him. The funny part about this is these two guys standing behind the villain, his thugs or whatever, raise their hand. And he goes, maybe next time, fellas. So darkly comic, darkly cheeky, because again, you have to think, well, you know, whether those two guys go with you or not, they're going with you. So he exits. But think about this. The second he's out of the room, the mask is off. Everyone concludes being their individual character. And by the way, this also means that every single joined person can behave as an individual. And that's terrifying. You know, that they're that duplicitous. And how come nobody's thought about that? That it's not... Hi, Carol, we'd like to help you. It's this duplicitous nature of, to your face will be really cool, but behind your back, it's time to eat some humans.
Yeah, it's much different. You get a little sense of how the sausage is made, right? But we pick up the very next scene with Kumbaa as he is in a hot tub with his, I guess we could call it a harem, or is it a harem if they're all just one hive mind? I don't know. But he's in the jacuzzi with his girls, and he even invites the housemaid in to join them. But his revelries are soon dismissed by the hive mind, as there is indeed a guest on the way. And this guest is somebody that they don't want to be around anymore.
Also, his reaction in them leaving, and he's like, whoa, whoa, what's going on? Well, you have a visitor. And here's the thing, is he can't even take that as an answer. As they're walking away, he's like, yeah, but don't we have time for a little bit of... And they're like, nope. And he slumps back in disappointment. And I'm like, this guy. And of course, he's disappointed because he's got to break away from... And I'm going to say it in this way, and I think this is a good place to drop it. The hive mind are his drug. And they give him anything and everything that he wants. And now when Carol shows up, mom's home, got to stash the drugs, even though I don't want to. It says a lot about his character and his behavior. The hive mind is a drug for him.
The hive mind is essentially a dopamine producer for Kumbaa. And whether that is the constant hit of dopamine that you get from posting on social media and receiving a like, or sitting down and scrolling through different funny videos, that's all just providing you with these quick hits of dopamine. And we see that once the hive mind has to retreat away from Carol, he's no longer getting those constant dopamine hits that he would normally get. So I thought that exemplified not only a drug addiction, but the same addiction that we have to things like technology and social media. And when that's taken away, you know, there's a little bit of petulance that comes along with that.
This leads us to the hotel suite sequence where he's trying to be charming and pouring champagne. As we make our way through the hotel and the suite and all that with Carol, she sees images of him everywhere. When she pulls into town, there are these huge banners of him. When you get into the hotel and particularly into his suite, there are photographs of him posed in all kinds of suits and up close. But when she gets to the suite, we get to have a conversation between she and Kumbaa.
And it's an interesting conversation. At this point, we find out while Carol is here to deliver this video and provide proof to Kumbaa that the hive mind is using dead bodies as their sustenance, we find out that indeed Kumbaa already knows at this point. And he says, is this about them eating people? And she says, what? And he says, it's troubling. And that's all. That's all we really get as far as his feelings on the hive mind consuming human corpses. This is when we get our guest star of the episode. As Kumbaa puts on a video, we have John Cena pop up in a little vignette explaining exactly what HDP really means.
Absolutely. And you have this silly soundtrack in the background. The colors and the typefaces are all wonky and weird. And even his delivery is rather stilted. But the goal of this, very simply, is to explain HDP or explain how and why they're using humans for sustenance. Now, as we step into this with the opening line, John doesn't introduce himself as "this individual is." He says, "We are John Cena." And I think that that's important because before they were willing, I'll say, to point out the fact that they are individuals still to you. This individual is X, right? Now they've just simply removed that. And I think as we move along, we're going to see more of the removal of the Midwest kindness in these characters. And they're going to become less and less, "we care about you," and be more, "we care about the hive mind." So yeah, him introducing himself as "we are John Cena" versus "this individual is John Cena," I think is important.
And we've even seen that with the hive mind's breakup with Carol. But we find out that they're consuming human-derived protein, which, from what your theory is, it isn't quite enough protein for a human or quite enough sustenance for a human to really live off of. But he gives a fairly in-depth, almost middle school description of the process of consuming these dead bodies, even up to the particular calorie intake.
This is where the deep dive comes in, right? He goes through their no-kill philosophy. And again, I want to remind us of the conversation we had about the hive mind's philosophy. And I find it difficult to believe that just because we've rewritten our RNA and that supposedly we're all on the same page, that that page universally becomes this. Number one, they cannot harvest wheat, corn, or rice. So they say they can't harvest anything. Then they say, "we cannot pluck an apple from a tree." This is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, what is an apple in so many philosophies, religions, thoughts? It is knowledge. And nope, we can't do that. They can harvest windfall items, meaning if the wind blows, the apple falls, they can eat it. They can milk animals that require milking. That seems logical to me. Look, we have the apple and the tree and knowledge kind of thing, but look at all these things that they say they cannot do. Who is telling them they cannot do it? I liken this to a religion later on, but there are so many things about what they can't do, and it's to their detriment too, right? It's to their detriment not to harvest wheat. It's to their detriment not to pluck the apple from the tree. It's to their detriment, in some ways, really not to raise cattle and have meat. So why are you defending life, but they'll place themselves in a scenario that they will starve themselves? And their answer is to process human corpses for the minimal amount of caloric intake that they can get from that. And they even say there are millions of tons of pre-existing food, but even the existing food and the windfall will only get us so far. There's a caloric deficit. And so because of the caloric deficit, we've created HDP. Then on top of that, they sell it with these phrases. So again, words are extremely important on this show. "We had to take certain measures." Anybody that ever says that in a movie or a television or a book, that is a villain line. "We had to take certain measures." Okay. "Otherwise it would go to waste." Okay, hold on a second. That's a human corpse. That's not something that goes to waste. And he even mentions, we know that through human history that it's been frowned upon. Yeah. Here's some more important phrases in there. For those that we are consuming, we do cherish their memory. I don't think this is about who they were. I'm thinking this is about the data that they pulled from their bodies, which, by the way, let's bring this all the way back around. The reason that you would keep a human head is that you could pull the data from it. And another one, appreciate their sacrifice, he says. Now they're sacrifices. And they just told us that they are sacrifices because he brings something up later in the conversation. So remember the sacrifice part. We were left with little choice, he says, and on a daily basis, up to 100,000 people die of natural causes and accidents. Hold on a second. Y'all came in here and killed 800 million people to do this, and what happens to those people that do die of natural causes and or have already been dealing with disease or anything else? And if you are this hive mind that is so perfectly in sync, how in the F are you having any accidents? How do accidents happen in a perfect hive mind? And now what is the Soylent Green actually being used for? Why are they putting 8 to 12% of it into this mana drink that they're creating for themselves? Here's what I think. And if you're not ready for a major theory, then close your ears for a second. The reason that the joined make stupid decisions, like processing human body parts for food or giving Carol a grenade, is because they're programmed and that they are programmed to become extinct. And that is why a majority of the human beings have joined or been joined, and that their goal isn't to survive. Their goal is to burn off in less than 10 years, is what he says. And anybody can come in and take over.
I like that theory quite a bit. Yeah, I think it coincides with a lot of things that we've heard in the past, but particularly when we hear the hive mind talk about things like a biological imperative. It makes sense that their biological imperative to join everyone and have these very strict rules of what they're able to utilize for sustenance in order to make the human species go extinct. Considering that this RNA sequence was sent from somewhere in outer space, possibly by potential invaders looking to eclipse the highest race on the planet. So it makes a lot of sense. I don't know if I agree technically with everything that you put down, but I think the vast majority of it I can sympathize with and back you up on. Like, there are a lot of cultures that believe that if you defeat a foe and consume them, you gain their powers. So it makes sense why they would have a human head there if they want to assimilate whatever knowledge that they had. And it would make sense that their biological imperative includes not only not harming anything living, including vegetation, but potential invaders.
Absolutely. But here's what I'm thinking again. And it goes back to the efficiency of resources. Would it be easier, faster, whatever, to destroy 8 billion people? Or would it be easier, faster to allow themselves to destroy themselves? It's one theory, but here's the reason I bring the whole thing up. It was my way of dealing with the Soylent Green issue, because that part of it just bothered me. It can't just be that only, here's the answer, and that's it. I think they're putting it in our face because that's what they want us to do and go, yep, it's Soylent Green. That's how we go. No, it's not Soylent Green. That is another one of the stupid ways that the hive mind will kill itself. And now it's willing to starve itself. In 10 years, most of the human population will die off from starvation. Not all, most. But those are just my thoughts just on that video alone. I mean, they're giving us a lot. This episode is a huge information dump. It's not innocuous. It's vital.
And this brought up a thought for me, and this came up while I was watching the episode as far as extinction goes. There's no mention of breeding at all to continue the life of the hive mind. So even if everyone is joined, and even if they did have the sustenance, if they're not breeding, then within 100 years, the hive mind's going to die out anyway.
And so they watch the video, and there's a confirmation at the end from John Cena. He says, "You are not obligated to consume HDP. We will never serve HDP to you. We already assume that you don't want anything to do with it. Regrets on not being able to speak in person, but for this time being, we still need our space." And now this is where Kumba has his confession. You know, he admits that he learned about HDP about a week ago. Carol once again asks him, "Jesus Christ, why are you so..." And she just lets that hang in the air to give us a really great incomplete question.
At this point, twice, he mentions that it's only troubling to him. He brings that up twice. It's troubling that they consume humans. But it doesn't seem to negate that he loves the hive mind.
He does leave it up in the air, though, as to what his motivations are and why he's so okay with everything. You know, why is he so compliant, naive, willful, whatever. But he does remind her that they didn't say that they were vegetarians. They said that they would prefer not to consume animal products. Mm-hmm. And that is a very interesting distinction that we also made watching the episode. And she says, "At least all the fucking lawyers survived." Yeah. And then, of course, Kumba says, he goes, "I'm in no way pleased." The moral gymnastics are pretty impressive with that one there. We also discovered that the other survivors knew about the food situation as well. The other 13 survivors are already hip to it. Not only that, but they meet on Tuesdays and Fridays. And Carol obviously feels left out. And he just says, "We took a vote and we just thought it would be better because we wanted to avoid drama." And I'll say this about the show moving forward, too. If you ever see Vince reiterate something, specifically exactly the same thing again, which he does twice in this episode, he's really saying you need to pay particular attention to that. And I think this is important. He reiterates the 10-year timeline. And then he also brings up the thing about the robotic farming, which I thought would be a great way to solve this whole situation here, right? And they're like, "No, we would have to build the machines." That sounds like a refusal to me. And it's also another extremely dumb way not to prevent everyone from starving to death. And this is where I was struggling with the whole Soylent Green issue. Is this like Idiocracy part two here? And these people really are this stupid? Or are they programmed?
I took that particular point, especially around the robotics, as very similar to the idea of gun control, right? Some people's opinion on guns is that it's not the guns that the problem, it's the people that are the problem. So we shouldn't put any control on guns. And it's the same thing in this case, where if they were to make these robots, it's the same thing as making guns and utilizing that to kill things, in this case, plants. And instead, you could just not make guns and you wouldn't have a problem of killing quote unquote plants. So I don't think it's anything about an idiocracy or going into extinction or anything like that when it comes to the robotic problem in particular. I think they don't want to create tools that create death. That's what I got out of that particular point. At least.
I mean, yeah, I don't disagree with you on their excuse. So he also says something here. "Ultimately, this is not about you, Carol," meaning it's about someone or something else and not the other 13 and maybe even not the joined, because his second sentence is, "or any of us for that matter." And I think it's a bigger statement than what it comes off as for as simply as it's written. But she gets really upset when he says that. And she's like, "Where's your nearest bathroom?" And she goes into the bathroom. And when she does, she shuts the door. And of course, we see this garish picture of Kumba.
Favorite, my favorite picture.
She scoffs at Kumba's photo on the wall. This is Ray again. She sits down on the edge of the bathtub and she expresses upset, scared, mad, get your shit together, resolved, and calculating in the matter of about 30 seconds.
It's really incredible.
I could watch that scene 100 times. It's ridiculous. She's far too good. She just needs to stop. But I'll say this about her, most certainly. She will fight those emotions, and fighting them and tamping them down isn't the healthiest behavior. And I think throughout the series, we are seeing her open that valve up a little bit more. And it also allows her to regulate herself in a way to think clearly. As you mentioned in the previous episode, she shot the video, she viewed it, she realized that she needed to do a retake. That's a very thoughtful process there. And I think we're moving from her being a reactive person to being a more responsive and thoughtful person.
I don't know about you guys out there, but a single glass of champagne, it instantly knocks me out. Same thing with wine. I'm out like a light. But she does accept the champagne and she does fall asleep. And we get the most human scene of Kumba so far in the entire series, where he pulls the glass of champagne away from her and lays a blanket down on her.
And it extends into his phone conversation that happens next. He calls the hive mind and he says, she's lonely. And you can't hear what they're saying. And he goes, yes, I understand. And he's just trying to express to them him feeling her loneliness. I also believe that he's also feeling his own loneliness, not because everybody's gone, but when you step away from your drug or you step away from your social media for an extended period of time, you feel it and you start to go, oh, you know what? Maybe that isn't the right thing. And again, I think it's a helpful turning point here. And I would say, most importantly, in this particular scene, because one, he's trying to compel them to come back and, you know, provide her with this comfort that she needs so desperately as people around her, even if it's the joined. And he, of course, overdoses on it every single day, surrounding himself with Casino Royale. And in this moment of quiet, he's on the phone and I think he sees himself in her, and then he hangs up with them and it's a very, very clear scene. He walks over to the window that faces out over Vegas and you see almost as clearly as he's standing there, his reflection in the glass. And you can see in his face, he is reflecting on his situation here. And realizing that, unfortunate for Carol as it is, she is the antidote to this thing. And whenever anyone that is not joined interacts with her, they get a dose of reality. They get pulled away from their dream or their fantasy or the delusion, frankly. Now, in that same shot, in the background, they're staying at a place that's called Westgate. And the only thing you see in the window is the gate part. And I think this is important because I believe in some ways he is the gate, or he is the gatekeeper for conversation and knowledge between he and the joined and he and the other survivors. What I like to think is that he's also ultimately the gatekeeper to the answer to Carol's problem. And that he has the answer, or may have the answer later, as to how we can reverse this. And I think that's why he's going to end up being a very important character in the future.
This brings us to the next scene. And this is where Carol wakes up the next morning and Kumba has made her breakfast. We've got some toast, avocado, eggs, and bacon, a very nice breakfast by all means. But something interesting happens while they're eating, and I want to get your thoughts on this, because as he's eating, he's taking his meal ingredient by ingredient, right? And then Carol smashes the avocado into the toast and throws some eggs on top of it, slaps a couple slices of bacon on there, and proceeds to nosh away. But as she's doing that, Kumba begins mimicking her.
Potentially, he grew up poor and he didn't grow up with everything that a lot of people have the privilege to grow up with. And so he didn't even know about smashing avocados into a piece of toast and covering it with eggs and bacon. Also, it's a cultural connection, right? Mimicking is cultural connection. So he's unconsciously even almost syncing with her to seek that human connection that he's really denied himself. He hasn't surrounded himself with real human beings. He's surrounded himself with robots, essentially. And so having a real human being in front of you doing real human things on their own, in their own individual way, that's the most unique thing that's probably happened to him in the last week, even though he was James Bond a minute ago. I want to throw out a stupid theory. Can I just throw out a stupid theory?
Please do.
He's a plant. And so as a joined, you can still behave as an individual, as we learned at the beginning of this episode. And perhaps, as you mentioned in a previous episode, one or more of our immune may not actually be immune. We don't know because we still haven't, in my opinion, undeniably answered the fact of whether they can lie to us or not, or be deceptive. And I'm going to say that they can, especially with them going from James Bond to, as soon as he leaves the room, completely shutting off and then getting rid of everything. It just, that's duplicity in its greatest sense.
I think it very much could be a small hint of Kumba coming around to the Carol way of thinking. I think that that could be in place there.
I like that.
I want to push back on a couple of things that you had mentioned there, though.
I dare you.
I think particularly in this episode, I want to push back on the fact that there seems to be some individuality within the hive mind. I think it's more of they're able to masquerade as individuals as opposed to there being still some individuality within the hive mind.
I don't disagree with you on that. That is exactly what I was trying to say. So,
yeah, oh, okay, absolutely. Perfect. The other thing, and this is a disagreement I think we had in the previous episode, going back to where Carol was writing on the whiteboard about her finding out that they cannot be deceitful. I think Vince Gilligan, as a writer and a storyteller, is intentionally very much spelling out that this is a hard and fast rule for this world, that they cannot be deceitful. They cannot lie. Erasing the question mark and underlining cannot lie. I very much think that's a part of his visual language where he wants to say to us, this is indeed a rule. And I think we both have different trains of thought on that. But
look, I'm a suspicious person at heart. So there's that. But I'll say this to back your line of thinking. As I said earlier in the episode, if you ever see him reiterate something, especially if you see him reiterate something very specific, as he does twice in this episode, he's obviously done it in that situation too. So I can hold on to that.
That's what I love about this, man, because there's a lot of other stuff out there where you don't get this level of theorizing and satisfaction out of the conversation around it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Well, I tell you what, she says, you know what, I'll pick out one of my own suites here and I'll clean up. And you could very clearly see on Kumba's face his dismay. And that's very much the dismay of the 13-year-old, you're keeping me away from my video games, you need to leave now. It keeps him from his drugs. And so he gets the look and she reads it very quickly. And in a progressive version of Carol, she goes, oh, I'm just fooling with you. And he's like, you know, thank God. She goes, why would I stay here anyway? This is like a $1 trillion lit up ashtray. to Kumba's response, he says, I'm sure it's no Albuquerque.
That's a great line.
But we do get to this sort of apple conversation in the foyer of his suite as he's walking her out. And he says, and again, this is where it becomes sort of religion-y, if that's a word. He's walking her out and he goes, well, you know, if there's any way that you could maybe even try to help us figure out a way to help these people not starve. And she says, I don't know, tell them to pick a fucking apple. And then she tries to take a few steps back, but she can't. Yeah, she says, no, actually, no. But he says, just like an evangel would, he says, they do not see it that way. Is it tolerance? Is it capitulation? It's so weird. And it was just a strange way to have an answer to anything, like, I don't know, cannibalism or any of the other weird things that they've been doing since we've met them. But I think it was very important because she points out something that's so blatantly obvious, that the biological imperative of a human being would be to pluck the apple.
So this point in the conversation with Kumbaa, we find out that the hive mind has seemingly solved their problem of making the remaining survivors join into the hive mind, but they can't do it without their consent, since it seems to take stem cells from the separate survivors that need to be specifically tailored to that person. And those stem cells need to be retrieved by a long needle via the hip bone. And that is a very painful process. And of course, knowing the hive mind and knowing their thoughts on not only consent, but harming another individual, we realize at this point that the hive mind needs consent from each of the survivors to harvest their stem cells and create this, I guess we can call it an antidote, to become one of the joined. And much as I theorized prior, Kumbaa has decided that he does not want to be a part of the joined, much like Carol. He's very much an individual, and he very much relishes being this individual amongst the rabble. He does not want to be a part of the hive mind. And at this point, we get Carol's first interaction with the hive mind as she denies the consent to harvest her stem cells.
And I would add another factor on to Kumba's line of thinking here. He doesn't want to go back to his old life, whatever that may be. If he was a con man, a petty thief, a dishwasher at a restaurant, he doesn't want to go back to that. And who would, after becoming almost king of the world here? But yeah, she wants to verify, so she has to call and listen to that message, which is more and more painful every time you have to listen to it, but also painfully comic. But they do verify that her wishes will be respected, that it's too invasive and painful for them to do it without direct permission. I want to posit another theory here, and this is a big theory. So again, if you don't want to hear this theory, cover your ears. But this theory is Carol is the cure. I think if you are one of the immune, and in this case, Carol, and there obviously is something that makes her and them different, wouldn't it be logical that you could derive an antidote from Carol's blood and see that injected into a joined and see if they don't return as themselves?
Yeah, I haven't thought of that personally, but I like where your head's at, and it's very much The Last of Us zombie apocalypse kind of feel, where there are immune folks and they are indeed the possible cure to this virus.
Yeah. I also say this too. We kind of have to get somebody turned from the joined back to normal before the end of this season. Can we get that? I'm just asking. I'm going to put that out there.
We may indeed see it. Yeah. We may indeed see that. It would be interesting. And who would you want it to be? I would foresee it being probably Zosia, possibly.
No, when I first thought of it, I wanted it to be the most unconventional person. Just make it the most unconventional person that you possibly could. Make it Larry.
Make it Larry. Yeah, that's what I was going to say too.
Make it Larry. I'm going to make t-shirts now that say Make It Larry my chest. And by episode 9, we better have Larry back to his original sunburned bike riding self. So let me add another double caveat to that. Not only is she the cure, but in order for her to become the cure for all of humanity, she'll have to sacrifice herself.
I can see it, certainly.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it. So she leaves, and as she's leaving, we see that Kumbaa has a Lamborghini for every day, and they're even dated with Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. And he leans into the car window to say something. For what it's worth, the world is doing the best it can. It misses you. Zosia misses you. They want you to come back, Carol. They want you to have a change of heart. Mm-hmm. And I want to break this down for just a split second. When you first say, for what it's worth, the world is doing the best it can, I immediately just think of Earth and the world. And then he says, it misses you. Not we miss you or they miss you. It misses you. And I think that that's important. Then he starts to give a breakdown. Zosia misses you. They want you to come. Well, now it's just the hive mind is what you're saying. And now you're saying that the hive mind is doing the best it can. And what's Carol's response? Fuck them. Watch your toes.
Yeah.
And she peels out of the parking lot.
Again, anything that Vince Gilligan says in one of his shows, even if it's just a small one line, there's meaning behind everything that he does. And I agree with you that when he specifically says it misses you, there's something there.
And arriving late, later than most episodes would, we finally get our timestamp. And our timestamp is also quite a bit different than previous timestamps. And if you guys stick around, I will go through our timestamp theories at the very end, just for those folks that are as nerdy as I am. The first timestamp that we see on the screen in this episode is 12 days, 12 hours, 42 minutes, and 58 seconds. And it ticks up to 43 minutes and 0 seconds until it reverses and goes all the way back to 9 days, 18 hours, 16 minutes, and 58 seconds. And then we see it tick up to the 17 minute and 0 second mark. Now, we've never seen the time go up and then go in reverse and then go back up again. Uh-huh. And during this small sequence here, we also hear a ticking clock in the background. But what do we reveal? It's actually our friend's egg timer in Paraguay.
Who has now become my favorite character, Minusos, as he is continuing his search across the different radio signals. And we see now that he's coming to the very end of the frequencies that he's searching out. He gets to, I think it's 9.999.0. And we find out that there's nothing on that frequency. But interestingly enough, he turns back a few pages and goes back to another frequency, which is 8.613.0. And he has a question mark with this frequency within his notebook. And as he readjusts back to that frequency, we hear that some sort of mechanical sound. To my mind, it brought the idea of a garden sprinkler. That's what I got out of it, but I'm sure it's something else.
I'm surprised it didn't remind you of an EDM song, because that was my first thought. I was like, oh, somebody's working on a beat there.
It could be. Yeah, they're working on some grind cores or whatever. Yeah, whatever. Whatever's popular now with Gen Z. But the first thing I thought of is this is the frequency the hive mind communicates on.
Okay.
The only frequency that's being used, because this psychic glue that holds the hive mind together, it's not magic. There is a scientific explanation for how they communicate. And I'm no expert, I'm no scientist, but it would make sense if they communicated via radio waves, because they do carry incredibly far. In fact, they carry outside of our atmosphere and into space. So it would make sense that there is a frequency on which they do communicate.
No, I like it as well. It reminds me of our scientists in the very first episode chasing down this signal that kicks off every 78 seconds. Yeah, when he rolls back to 8.613.0, he does receive some sort of a signal. And I listened to it probably about 4 times. And it sounds like there is some math in there as well. It would be like 2 instances, 3, 4, 3, 5. It's almost like a numbers station kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. The frequency 8.613.0 is actually not a frequency that anyone uses. It's considered to be in between frequencies. And I thought if he specifically chose this, he's not looking for anyone that's on the frequency, like the joined, he's looking for someone that's off the frequency, that's in between, that is not a part of. And it rings true for the themes that I think are in the show. What happens next is really interesting, though, too, because he goes back out, as he did in the previous episode, to investigate the food that they dropped off. And we find out why he's having such a hard time fighting not eating this food. It's literally his mother's cooking. Mm. And that's got to be extremely difficult to pass up, especially with the food that they displayed before. I'm sure it was marvelous. But he receives an envelope in the mail, and it is not a data card. It's not a CD. It is a VHS tape.
Which, if you have listened to any of our Dad, You're Wrong episodes, you know that we are indeed very big fans of VHS tapes. But this particular VHS tape is the first message from Carol, as she is explaining her initial findings that she sent out. This seems to prove to Manny, as I call him now, in my own personal take, that Carol is indeed a survivor like him. And not only that, that she has the same thought process of the hive mind as
him. Yeah, they're of like mind without a doubt, yeah.
But this video inspires him to finally break out of this prison. And at this point, when he finally leaves the self-storage facility, we even have a shot of him opening the gate. And as he's exiting, the camera switches to behind the gate, and we see him leaving that confined prison that he made for himself. Any future shots we see of him are very much like the shots we've seen of Carol throughout this episode, where she's very much framed in the center of the frame now, as opposed to being in a small portion of the frame and seeing a lot of the surroundings, often empty surroundings. Now we see Manousos very much in the center of the frame, and he's no longer obstructed. And this is exemplified in the shot as he's walking down the streets of his city. And as he's walking down the streets, you see the streetlights coming on around him. So he very much sees that they're aware of him exiting this prison. And as he re-enters the world, it lights up around him. And he's going back to his house, where he finds some food and he's gathering supplies. And it very much seems as if he is finally determined to make the trip that we've been waiting for and finally go to meet Carol.
And this is the scene, again, I alluded to earlier, where he's doing the reiteration. All of her narrative is from the video that she shot that we already know. We've already heard it. Mm-hmm. Now he's hearing it for the first time. And what they do marvelously with this moment is it's her voiceover as he's going through his last actions here at the storage facility. The video ends, she reiterates again about how it's so important that you enjoy your individuality while you have it before the virus is forced upon you. And in that last moment, make sure you treasure your individuality. And that's when he exits the gate and you see him walking out. So it's marvelously mirrored in her voiceover, his action as he makes his way through this scene. If you just watch this last 12 minutes of the episode, it is a horror film. It's a guy who is having to stay in a creepy place. He gets a mysterious video. There's a creepy woman standing outside of his house. Everything's starkly lit. When he goes down through town to get back to his apartment, everything's dark. And then all of a sudden, all the lights are on. That's very much a horror film scenario there.
And quite honestly, this ending sequence with Manousos was far and away my favorite portion of the episode.
Oh, very cool.
I really love this portion. When he returns home, as soon as he gets in, he's yelling out, "If anybody's in here, you better come out now." And of course, nobody's in there. But he's going back essentially to gather supplies to make this trip up to Carol. He's gathering all the supplies that you would want in a zombie apocalypse. Even going back to previous episodes, he treats this as if it were a virus pandemic.
Yeah. Once he does get into his apartment, though, he stands there in the doorway, and to his right, you very clearly see a photograph of what seems to be a father and a son. And they really made it sit there for a minute. And I think it's important and it might play into Manny's character.
And within this apartment, we get a particular shot that I like that's mirrored in the final shot of the episode. From the camera's perspective, we have two distinct paths. We have one path that is an empty hallway that leads to a crucifix, which almost seems to mean that this is the path of the solitariness of religion. And that could be a path of how Minousos goes about approaching the hive mind, which has been in the past making a prisoner of himself. And then, of course, on the right side of this path, we have him as he is now gathering
his go bag,
the necessary things he needs to make this trip to find Carol, because he's found a kindred spirit. And that's reflected in the final scene as well. As he's exiting and he hops in his car, which is a very distinct yellow, he hears somebody speaking to him off to the side. And we see that there is a woman silhouetted in the darkness here. And again, in a very horror movie fashion.
Absolutely. The yellow MG midget. Who wouldn't want a little MG midget to tool around in? It'll be interesting to see him making it through the entirety almost of South America and Mexico to get up to Carol. When we get outside, he fires up the midget and he starts to drive it out of the garage and it stalls on him right there. And what I love about this scene is I can imagine most people watching this scene are completely confused on what's going to happen next with this car. But there is a woman standing starkly there in the shadow, and it's very much like a horror film. But we discover that this is his mother. And she says, you know, we can help you. Let us help you. Do you have questions? We have answers. And he goes, but you can't be my mother because my mother was a bitch.
Such a Carol line, right?
Ain't it though? But he's also being honest, right? He's also saying, your character is different than my mother. There's no way you are my mother. And this is the reaction I feel like all the other 13 or 12 should have had. You are obviously not my son. You are obviously not John Cena anymore or whatever. But these two people of all the world are like, nope. I'm like, gosh, I'm definitely on this team. But you could see how the joined were trying to manipulate him in the same way that they were trying to manipulate Carol by using his own mother. Again, how tasteless and wrong and stupid to do that. And not only that, but her lovely cooking. It's like, how can you damn this woman's cooking by doing this? That's terrible. But he's not buying it. He's not buying any of it. And so what does he do? He push starts the MG, which is what you can do with a vehicle like this if the battery happens to be low. And he kicks up some smoke and rolls on down the road.
And in this shot, again, it's another shot of two separate paths that Minousos can take. He can take the top left path, which seems to be the more brightly lit path, which is where his quote-unquote mother had come from, and which is why we've seen her in such stark relief. But he instead takes the other path, which leads down into the darkness. And I think they're saying a lot of things about Minousos' choice in both of these scenes, where there is possibly an easier path and he has now finally made the decision to go down into the depths and join Carol where she is. I think finally getting Carol out of her loneliness and adding an ally to the cause is going to change the dynamic of the show in a pretty stark way. And I'm very much looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too. So again, another phenomenal episode. To be honest, I was very pleased to be able to find my own way around the Soylent Green issue. Do you have any final thoughts on this episode before we move into the bonus material?
There's a lot to contemplate and a lot that has changed my previous theories. And quite honestly, there's a lot that you had caught that I hadn't, that I am very much looking forward to pondering as I wait for the next episode. So another great episode of Pluribus. I loved it.
All right. Well, we appreciate you sticking around for an extra long episode. We had a lot that we wanted to go over and, you know, maybe some of it's relevant, maybe it's not, but I feel like we're talking about a lot of things that other folks aren't talking about. Would you like to bounce into some color theory? We can talk about the colors.
Perfect. Yeah, this is something that I had mentioned about not only Vince Gilligan's visual language, but how he utilizes color within his TV shows. And this is very much exemplified within Breaking Bad in particular, but he uses that to great effect within Pluribus as well. And this goes back all the way to episode one. And even the very first time we see Carol, she is wearing this very vibrant yellow jacket. I think we can both take that figuratively as well as literally. She is sort of this yellow jacket or this wasp in the hive, if you will. And she is this natural predator to the bees. And it really shows Carol as the threat that she is to the collective, the threat that she is to these bees in the hive, to the point where when Carol causes distress to these hive members, that they convulse, they end up seizing, very similar to what bees do defensively when they find a wasp that's invading their nest. They tend to vibrate. And this is also, by the way, how bees tend to communicate. They communicate with vibration. So that could very much be the psychic glue that the hive mind communicates with, and Carol being the largest threat to the beehive that they have encountered. And we see that throughout the series, this stark yellow color. The big one that pops into my mind when Carol opens the recycling bin and it has a very stark yellow lid on it. And of course, what does she find in there but the empty milk cartons? So it's almost guiding her to the answer of what could potentially be the weakness of the hive mind in this stark yellow lid on this recycling bin. Another way this popped up is with the poker chips. So when Kumba is doing his little casino royale routine, the bad guy who's got his cheesy little eye patch on and all that, he's betting with yellow chips, but he's also backing those yellow chips with a large stack of blue chips as well. And what do we see Kumba betting with? Exclusively yellow chips. So again, Kumba being very much an individual who does not want to join the hive mind is also exuding the same yellow color of what really means individuality. And there's many frames within this show that have the contrast of both the yellow and the calmer blues. And I think that's exemplified a lot in this final scene with Minousos, where he's choosing these separate paths and either choosing to go into the light or go into the darkness. So colors has a lot to do with Vince Gilligan's visual language. And when we see those, we can recognize some of the themes that he's trying to push out to us as this thing is going on here. But I know you have been talking about the timing and the clock that we've been seeing throughout the entire series. I'm very excited to hear your theory on this because I think we might have differing opinions.
Well, to bounce on what you had just mentioned, I also noticed when he was putting his go bag together that his backpack was also yellow. And I think you're absolutely right. I think it very distinctly points to individuality. My thoughts on timestamps here. Pluribus doesn't have timestamps that are standard. Here's 14 days later or anything like that. Everything is very precise. 12 days, 12 hours, 42 minutes, 58 seconds. That's all very tightly wound into that. And I think that how specific Vince is being with this isn't accidental. Where did I start? We started pulling the timestamps from every single episode. And honestly, for me, I went straight for prime numbers. So when we start to analyze these prime numbers versus non-prime numbers, we find something that's very interesting. Episodes 1 through 5 all had prime numbers built into their number sequence. Episode 5, where we get a dark reveal, had no prime numbers in it. And this episode here, with the multiple timing, had both prime number examples and non-prime number examples, because I think this is a transition episode, transitioning us into deeper truths, but then also doing the standard things, which is tell us the story, build on our characters, things like that. And whenever we see these sequences with Carol or Minussos, those are prime numbers. They are not part of the collective. That storyline is a prime storyline. The other ones are the composite storylines when we see more about the dark reveals or things like that. So the core thesis is Vince Gilligan is using prime numbers as narrative markers within the countdown timestamps. Primes represent immunity, individuality, and resistance, and composites represent corruption, the hive mind, and divisibility. The mathematics hinge between that horror and hope kind of thing. And I think that that's what he's dancing around. That is probably the biggest version of the timestamp thing that I can think of, that he's actually pointing out to us these prime numbers go to these folks, these composite numbers go over here, and that's all that it is. My second theory on the numbers is even simpler and better, in my opinion. When I first saw these timestamps in the very first episode, I thought, he's just putting these in here, and then that's it. There is no Easter egg. There is no secret. There is nothing. I kind of like that, to be frank, especially with all the math that I did to get here. And I did all the tricks. I tried to turn the numbers into letters to see if they spelled something. I tried binary, you know, 100011. Nothing else really matched up. The only thing that really matched up was that we had certain episodes that had those prime numbers and other episodes that did not have those prime numbers, and that they did make a tonal and theme difference in each one of the episodes. Those are the two theories that I have for the timestamps. I'm not really hearing anybody else out in the world really breaking down the timestamps and what they mean. My only other thing I'd like to add to the end of the timestamp, if it is arbitrary or if it is even part of the prime number theory that I have here, we start off with 439 days before the joining. It would be pretty cool and not unlike Vince to bookend his series with it ending with 439 days after the joining. And this is when our time frame is. We have these 14 months with which to play this story. And in the way that it's playing out, almost literally day by day here in front of us, we do have a lot of space here with 14 months to have the purported four seasons that Vince would like to have with this particular show. And he has said that he has a very, very good idea of how it will end, but, quote, if a better idea comes across my desk, I'll use it. Again, I think I would like to throw my theory in that Carol is the antidote and she may have to sacrifice herself at the end of the series in order to save all of humanity. But beyond that, my friends, that is as convoluted as you can get with the timestamp theory.
I gotta say that when we talked prior to the episode, you mentioned that you were going to dive deep into your number theory as far as the clock goes. I was very much prepared. If we were on another podcast, I would say, Dad, you're wrong. But upon hearing your explanation of the prime number theory, I think that is brilliant. I think that is so good. And I, honestly, at this point, if the theory were to break and it is just a clock, I might be a little bit disappointed because that is such a great theory. I really love the prime numbers not being divisible and the non-prime numbers or the composite numbers being divisible and that separating the different scenes and the different episodes. I think that is wonderful. I really, really enjoy that. I came into it thinking it is just a tool, right? I thought it was just a tool to...
Yeah, we're watching 24. We're just watching right. 24, that's all.
I thought it was just a Jack Bauer tool to show you how long the sequence of events have been. So I really, really like that theory. I hope that it is indeed something. And I certainly have not seen that out in the ether as people have been talking about the episode. So somebody call Vince Gilligan and tell him to listen to the podcast because I think he would be surprised by what you have found here because that is some pretty deep thinking. That's some deep research. And that is a very, very intriguing idea. So I like that quite a bit. And I'm very happy that you put in as much work as you have with these numbers so far.
Well, I appreciate it. It's definitely a nerdy pursuit, but I wanted to dig into that. But yeah, I'm sure we'll come up with more items as they hit our desk, so to speak, and we will deal with them accordingly. Other than that, I think we did a pretty good job throughout the episode just hitting on some of the core theories that either we're thinking about or are out there in the zeitgeist and people are bouncing around. If you have any theories, feel free to jump into any of our social media feeds and comment on any of the episodes or get a hold of us through your favorite podcast listening platform.
I think that'll do us for today, Carol. Thanks so much for joining us for episode 6 of E Pluribus Unum on the episode HDP. I would love for you to join us on our next favorite podcast, which is Dad, You're Wrong, where a Gen X dad and a millennial son talk everything from horror to sci-fi to fantasy. And I hope to see you guys next week. Thank you so much.